Moreover, let me emphasize something else. We don't want it any longer than 800 pages or a 16-page approval. We will not read anymore. We urge you to type. That makes a good impression on us from the beginning. The examination is set up so that it is, in effect, a two-hour examination. And please don't come to us and say, we don't have any time, it's Memorial Weekend, we have to get up into the woods. Nothing pressures, because it's not back till Thursday, and it's a two-hour examination. That is all it is. 8 typewritten pages and 16 blue book pages are all that we want. So don't forget then that it is due back between 10 and 11 a.m. on Thursday, June the 3rd. And there are no excuses. On Thursday between 10 and 11, we would like to see you personally in 5269 Humanities. All right, no much problem. Now, one word about the evaluations, which on the whole are very good. I think next time it's going to be taught, which is, if anybody is interested, will be the year after next. It will be 4 credits. I think that was a very good suggestion. And next time it will be taught another good suggestion. History 120 or the equivalent will be a prerequisite. I know that we've been suffering under the fact that it had no history prerequisite. But it will have a basic European history prerequisite from now on. Many of you asked for more visiting speakers. We had some, but they canceled out, unfortunately. And this is a matter of money. And if I can get some money from the United Jewish Appeal for this course, I'll try. It's a very good idea to have this on Fridays. To have visiting speakers on Fridays would be really the best idea. But that is a financial problem. So if you have parents who want to give some money to them, they can. Probably give money for a lot of nonsensical things. Now, I was puzzled by two matters which I cannot quite figure out, and I suppose you will never tell me. On the whole, we did pretty well in your evaluations. But on the organization of the course, one only got a 4 instead of a 5 by and large. And I was a little puzzled by that because there weren't enough comments with that to tell me. But I rather think, and this may be true or not, that this is a reflection of the difficulty that some of you had because you had no history prerequisites. The accessibility of the professor is only rated 3. That, I think, is really not totally fair, because I've always been here 50 minutes before, I've been here afterwards, I have 2 hours, office hours before this course, 3 times a week, and it is up to you. This was really puzzling to me, I must say. Because these are so shy, there's nothing I can do about it. The readings were criticized, and justly so. Now, there we experiment, but there are 2 things to be said for it. I think on the whole, using Anna Arendt so early in the course, or perhaps at all, was a mistake. I think it probably needed too much history background. I think we agree that that was probably a mistake. The other reading, I hope, will be better 2 years from now, because more things may come out. But you are extremely restricted in English reading for a course like this. And the things that you wanted, more novels, that actually we tried, but then we found that the novels we wanted were out of print. So this is difficult, but if tax, for example, ever comes into pocketbook, it certainly is something one could use in general as well. As for the general criticism under some stimulation, which I won't mention, that I have slighted the East European Jews, this is quite correct, of course. I'm nothing against it. But as I said in the last lecture, for you that isn't as relevant as what we did. So I really have made an apology for that, because the interesting problem is the problem of emancipation and what comes out of that, as far as I'm concerned. And perhaps one day we will have somebody here who could really do the history of the East European Jews. But let me remind you, to do the history of East European Jews properly, as there's nothing published in English, you have to know Yiddish and Hebrew, and I know neither Yiddish nor Hebrew. That is to say, if I knew Hebrew, I would know Yiddish, because Yiddish is just a standard form of German, actually, so it's very easy for me to understand. But I don't read it because it's written in Hebrew script. So that, and if I learn Hebrew ever, that tried not too successfully, which I think is somewhat in doubt, then I can also do a better job on East European Jews here than I have done. One cannot count in the future of having Alex Orbach here, unfortunately, because he's going out into the world one of these days. So I will eventually have to do it myself, because you can't count. You have been extremely lucky in having two instructors who know as much, and in many ways more than I do. You've been very lucky. I don't think that luck will repeat itself in the future, I'm afraid. But still, your evaluations were really very much to the point. And as I say, most of it we shall adopt 2 years from now, because you must realize that this is the first time, and therefore there had to be some experimental part in it. You know, a little difficult to know whom we were going to get, how it would strike you, all of that. You know, that was a little bit. I'm not saying I'll change my mind on anything, but I'm saying, of course, from what I know, which isn't Eastern Europe. Okay, now it's your last chance to ask any questions, and you might as well and not be so antsy about your examination, because you get that soon enough. And it's a brilliant examination, all three of us agree. Not just good, brilliant. Quote Mr. Orbach, at any rate. I agree, though. Oh, one other thing that always comes up and I forget. If you want your grade, please put a postcard in it. If you've forgotten a postcard, put it in our box. Though we have it graded next week sometime, it's very bad to be called all the time, because we usually don't have it with us wherever we go. So a postcard is a lot better. Now, I'm open to any last minute questions which you have. You have no questions, this has been a... Oh, yes, sir.
The last time, you seem to imply that the stress caused by anti-Semitism is a good thing, because it creates, you know, flowing moments. Should you feel that that stress is a good thing?
Well, it must be clear, though I haven't had many biases in this cause, and on the whole, I prefer coffee house Jews, that must be clear. I always spend a great deal of my time on the Union Terrace. So, and I really have very great personal, personal reservations and personal blocks about what we discussed as muscle Jews in many ways. So, but I still think it cannot be denied. I didn't say good or bad. That's neither here nor there. But it cannot be denied that from a point of view of Western culture, and that it must be our point of view after all, this tension between anti-Semitism or the dialectic, between anti-Semitism and emancipation has been for some people extremely true. This is usually written off as an argument of a diaspora too. Well, I don't care about that. The thing in Israel is still open. I haven't seen anything great of this nature yet. But the tension was certainly extremely fruitful, provided it was not high enough. That is why I said it was fruitful in the 19th century. It was fruitful really till 1933. Then after 1933, there was too much persecution, and the matter became no longer fruitful. That depends, I think, on a certain level of tension. Yes, I meant to say that, indeed. Yes.
Is your logical conclusion to this be, therefore, that normalization of the state of Israel, which is a territorial solution to the Jewish problem, would indicate a decline in Jewish creativity and distresses, would be...
Yes, I think so. Impressive, yes. Yes. Do I find it to be true? Yes. In many ways, I find it true. But that is a personal observation. Yes. It may be least true. It may be least true in the religious sphere. I'm told there are a lot of creative things going on in the religious. But I find it true in the sphere that I can evaluate, but not in the religious. That's a different matter. That's why I wanted to have Uri Tal here as a speaker so badly, because he knows all of this. And I've discussed it with him. And he says that in the religious sphere, this is totally different. And I just cannot judge, you see? I can just judge what I know.
What way you find this to be true?
In art and literature, especially. In music, perhaps too, but I'm not that familiar with it. Normalization, that's nothing any social psychologist or sociologist would say that normalization has certain consequences. You shouldn't be very surprised about that, especially normalization in which, by necessity, the stresses are quite different. The stresses on survival, the stresses on this and on that, the stresses and on the other, if you like. That's quite normal. I'm not knocking it, really. Yes.
Your argument, I think, is substantiated, but it doesn't go, I mean, it doesn't face the question. And that is, should that kind of tension be preserved?
Yes, I'm not raising the question. Maybe it should not be preserved, because for many people it obviously isn't fruitful but bothersome. I quite realize that. But the point I was making, that until 1933, for some people, it was extremely creative. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah. Even this tension, how comes to make the first with the nation? Is there any kind of creative tension?
Yes, there are many types of creative tensions. But if you examine the lives of the people that I mentioned, this is certainly one of the chief creative tensions. I don't think anybody would deny that. And especially if you examine, after all, the great contribution of the left-wing intellectuals, to whom I'm obviously quite friendly, and you can be quite hostile, but if you look at their creation, I'm not talking about Lukács or Marcuse or any of these people, this tension is very much at the root of it, which Marcuse would admit to you if you ever talked about it. But Marcuse, you see, is in a sense an exception, because he is not an anti-Zionist. So he is an exception even there. You see?
Yes. Yes, I just want to say, you found that an affinity the Jews had for one another, and
yeah.
You seem to discount pretty convinced, well,
was pretty sure of your denial that the reason for this affinity was something to do with the fact that what happened in Sinai.
Yes.
But you really sort of shrugged off what the reason might be. You said some sort of distinct name or something else. But I really don't think that's made any sense.
I didn't shrug it off. I was quite detailed about that. A communist modern historical tradition is what I said.
Yeah, who does that tell about that?
It entails a certain effect on your subconscious. It entails a certain effect upon the limitations of your actions. And as you may have seen from what we have done, it's in a way defines your options and still defines your options. So that this, I said, seems to me to be what is the element of affinity. I think I put it. And not Sinai. If you believe in Sinai, you come either to a national mystique, because historically it's more likely that your ancestors came from some bad Russian forest. You either accept a nationalist mystique, which you are quite, you can do, or you come to some kind of funny idea of the continuity of genes, which in my idea comes very close to racism. In other words, historically, it's very logical that you are this person. In fact, the evidence for that is extremely small. You know? Well, you can say the famous joke that I heard in my youth, why do so many Jews have flat feet? Because they walked in the desert. But that's a joke rather than the reality. You can accept it as a national mystique, but you must then accept it as what it is. Your ancestors did not stand there. Very unlikely. Very unlikely.
Yeah. One thing you talked about the situation of the Anglican history,
yes. Yes.
As far as the international finance section of that, that's still going.
In some ways, though after 1918 at any rate, Jews by and large were no longer prominent in international finance as they have been in the 19th century. And after 1932-3, not at all. That has something to do with an economic development, namely with the collapse and going out of private banks in favor of larger and semi-public banks. So that in 1933 on, at any rate, certainly, Jews no longer played a big role in international finance. And after the war, none at all. That's difficult to say. I suppose it does in a way. But now the conspiracy doesn't have to be put on finance. Now the conspiracy can be put on Jerusalem. Because finance is not convincing anymore. Now you have these great national banks and so on, and the old great families like the Ferrers in France, or the Warburgs in Germany, or Bleichröder in Germany, well, they no longer even exist. As far as I know, there are no great powerful international Jewish financial concerns at the moment. I may be mistaken, but I don't really think I am. I don't think they exist anymore.
Yeah.
You seem to speak through the genealogical marriage. That's one of the things. What about the
No. What about the cultural heritage? And here I must say two things. If there has to be a definition of the Jew, it has to be generic. So some of your immediate cultural heritage is East European, right? But that is not true for all Jews. So I cannot define a Jew in the terms of an East European heritage. The heritage of the Bible and the national mystique, I cannot define that way either, because too many Jews have either never gone to Sunday school, you know, or the Sunday schools were so bad that they really didn't get very much out of it, if you see what I mean. Therefore, to say that there's a coherent Jewish cultural heritage, which is what the Reconstructionists say, again, doesn't satisfy my definition, because there are too much who do not have this cultural heritage, right? Or too many who even overtly reject it. After all, for many of you, the East European cultural heritage was bound up with your grandparents, who didn't speak English properly, whom you were afraid to take to your school affairs, and all that sort of stuff. So many of you, I'm sure, rejected it. So it's really, you can't make any definition, you see. Besides, you see, then you come into the problem, what of that heritage really exists in Israel? That's a good question. It's more a mystique than a reality. You see what I mean? I don't know how many Israelis you ever talked to, but most of them would actually recognize what it is, a national mystique, rather than a continuing cultural heritage. Though in Israel, the cultural heritage is more dense, because Israel is in many ways an East European country. Because that heritage in Israel seems to me is very predominant. So that's what you have, therefore, here. But even there, you don't have it. You don't have it in that sense. So a common cultural heritage, if you're really interested in a revival, and this has a great deal of appeal, then you must look at what we call Reconstructionism. Because Reconstructionism does try to reconstruct Judaism on a cultural rather than a religious heritage. And for a lot of bright young kids, that has an enormous attraction. I know that when I teach in Jerusalem, I usually have in my class up to 9 or 10 young American radical kids who want to be Reconstructionist rebels. That has a great deal of attraction. But it's not a definition. It's a partial definition, don't you see? It may be your definition, but I have not tried to knock your definition or anybody's definition. You know, I have just tried to give a generic definition which can cover me as well as you. Because no cultural heritage definition could possibly cover me. You see what I mean? And there are lots of people like me. Probably more like me than I like me. You see, there were generations of Jews who never, like myself, went to Sunday school or anything of that nature whatsoever. You know? And therefore have no connection whatsoever with any kind of Jewish heritage, so to speak. You know, as you define it. You know? I know the Bible better probably than most people, but that is because of my work in the Reformation. I know the Christian Bible, I do not know the Jews. So, the question is, there are lots of people like that, and your definition has to cover them all, don't you see? Unless you read them out, then you have a sectarian definition, which from an historical point of view is uninteresting. You can read everybody out, people do that all the time, right? Yeah. Yeah, of course. Well, I'm sorry. Since emancipation, I think the values are too diffuse, and I cannot best will see anything since emancipation that I might call a common Jewish culture which people shared all the way from the Orthodox, let's say, to Toller or Eisler or Georg Lukacs, except what I did stress, the kind of ethical imperative. Yes, I stressed that, do you remember? But apart from that, no. No. What? They were expressionist poets, they were philosophers, they were God knows what. And I'm afraid I cannot see a common Jewish heritage. None of these people had, as a matter of fact, ever gone to Sunday school. And even if you go to Sunday school, many of you reject it. I know more yeshiva professors in Madison who have become militant anti-Jewish atheists than I ever thought possible. So we're going to do that, eh? Yes?
What would you attribute for them, let's say, present interest in Jewish culture and teaching nation in Jerusalem when, let's say, when you were married or when you were in college or you got all that done? What would you say to yourself?
Well, you know. I'm not an anti-Zionist, though I'm sure you all think I am. because I'm critical, and you were brought up in this American idea that everything Israel does is fine. It isn't. I would say 60% that happens there I thoroughly disapprove of, but that doesn't really matter. An intellectual is supposed to be critical, and I'm very critical. But why I teach in Jerusalem? Oh, there are many reasons why I teach in Jerusalem. I could give you, I start with a more flippant one. It's the last German university. And coming from Madison and into disturbances, believe me, it's wonderful. Jerusalem is also quiet. I can get a lot of work done. Nothing ever happens there. I can also get a lot of work done. It's also true. But on the other hand, I am deeply involved in the country because in the last resort, well, I believe that this is not a total solution. It is certainly probably, after what I have told you, one road to one solution. And I myself am not as hostile to that solution as you think I am. But I have to make clear to you that it is by no means the only solution. And it may not be the best solution for a lot of people. But as far as I am concerned, it has the beauty of a certain logic. I won't deny that. And I like the whole atmosphere. It's a very relaxed atmosphere. And while I said these tensions are fruitful, there are times when you want to get away from these tensions as well, I am mindful. And the tensions are different. And all of us, I mean of my generation, don't mind normalization, but the real reason is quite a different one. I mean, these are all reasons. The real reason, I'll tell you, is that Jerusalem is, for historical reasons, the last place where you still have a real intellectual community. That you don't have in the West anymore because it's too big and confusing. But Jerusalem is the last place I know a lot of places, where you still have a real intellectual community. And that this community is interested, what I'm interested in, is of course the great third class, if you want to put it that way. That is really, if you ask me, the bottom reason why I like it. It's a real intellectual community interested in problems in which I myself am interested. That doesn't mean that I can talk to the man in the street there any more than I can talk to the man in the street here. Never talk to the man in the street in any case. I'm an intellectual. I like to talk to intellectuals, don't you? I don't make any bones about that. I like to refurbish my liberal image now and then, but I think it's too late for that. So, it's the last real intellectual community. That comes because they're all intellectuals of a certain kind of tradition. You see? A Central European intellectual tradition, very largely, which I think is the best of only modern intellectual tradition. Some of the greatest people come from there. Marx and Hegel and all the things you're excited about come from Central European tradition. So, a Central European intellectual tradition. That's what I like. So I've given you another sense. But you must realize everything in life is ambivalent. There are no clear decisions. So that's the answer. But that does not mean, does not go counter to my definition of a Jew, which has taken everybody, even the American Council for Judaism. See? I mean, it doesn't exist. It's due from here and on. Money. You have to get it. Well, any more questions? You're all satisfied because you know everything now. Your consciousness has been raised. That is as much raised as you can attend in sections and lectures. Some of your consciousness is still at the low thing. Now, remember, the exams that you Thursday, and remember to pick one up that you're in.